before. Baby, it's not mine. Not a chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are right smack dab in the middle of it. Right smack dab in the middle. We are right smack dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with normally my guest, Charlotte Littlefield. She's off tonight. She had to go pick up a daughter on the Amtrak train coming into St. Louis, so she won't be with us tonight. We'll certainly sorely miss Charlotte Littlefield. Anyway, we've got quite a program tonight. I'm going to cover 7 ideas of slavery is what I've, termed them, 1 through 7. And then beginning the second segment, Tony Gosling's coming in from England. By gosh, Bristol, England. He's going to give us an update on the scandalous Olympic Games security flap. This G4S company just dropped the ball. They got a tremendous contract, but they weren't able to follow through on it. But there was a tremendous burden of security clearing and also training that they needed to do. So the company maybe took on a gargantuan task and fell short. The BBC is out. Actually, Tony Gosling added this story. He first exposed the shortfall that G4S company was experiencing and added it, and he was right up there on breaking that story originally. We want to congratulate Tony Gosling on that, but he'll be live with us from Bristol, England in about 15 minutes. The ideas of slavery, as I term them, if you go to thesecrettruth.com, I've listed those right there, and I says first segment, those will cover the 7 most enslaving ideas. You might have your own 7 or 10 or 15 or whatever. These I came up with this afternoon just off the top of my head as big ideas, concepts, or conjectures, or even assertions that keep us locked into a system of slave thinking or thought slavery. Anyway, let me tick these off real quick, and we'll get through as many of these as we can before the second segment, then we'll bring on Tony Gosling from England. Number 1, 9/11 attack. Number 2, know thyself. Number 3, the mainline media. We're going to quote something about that. Number 4, governments create jobs and wealth. Number 5, the ultimate wealthy fund only capitalism. Number 6, the Federal Reserve System is owned by the federal government. And number 7, the delusion is hogwash. Let me go back to number 1. And state what they're putting out. The 9/11 attack was a legitimate terrorist attack from outside of the United States. On the right side of the table that I put up, I put truth and then dot, dot, dot. And here's my response to that assertion. There are top 40 reasons to doubt the official story of September 11, 2001. And these are on 911truth.org. If you're not seeing this page, or you can pull it up on your own computer. But anyway, number 1, AOL, chain of command, air defense failures, Pentagon strike, it was an hour and 20 minutes later, there was no response there from the Andrews Air Force Base. War games were going on, Flight 93, Shanksville, there wasn't enough wreckage there. Do cell phones work at 30,000 feet? No. Demolition hypothesis of World Trade Center 7, it was a classical implosion. Okay, let's get on to 8. What did officials know and how did they know it? The government knew there were FBI informants working with some of these people. Surveillance of alleged hijackers was going on before the 9/11. Obstruction of FBI investigations prior to 9/11. There was inside trading going on the airline stocks that were involved in 9/11. Who were the perpetrators. They had them all picked off right after 9/11. It was just too pat. Bin Laden had fought in on our side in Afghanistan against the Soviets and helped run those them out. All the signs of a systematic 9/11 cover-up, poisoning New York City with all that debris and that smoke and that acid, and just very, very cautious, noxious fumes, I should say. Okay, there was anthrax mailing mixed into this to get Congress to sign off on, you know, Homeland Security. The Stonewall, there people just started, you know, clamming up and so forth. Anyway, go to that site. I have it here. It's and it's the top 40 reasons. Okay, now number two, another idea that is used to enslave is know thyself. We really know ourselves and are aware of our personality traits and personal characteristics. Now, here's what I say about the truth about that. It's very difficult to accomplish the idea or the goal of knowing ourselves because we're thinking from within our own minds. But we can reach out and ask friends what they think about us and just tell them what's the worst trait of that you dislike about me. And then tell them their worst trait too. But anyway, you can reach out to friends, you can take personality tests, and you can try to see oneself. The problem with this is our ego state and this so-called false self that continues to grab upon and look to the outside world to reinforce itself. But in a much more abstracted way, men, I believe, suffer more deeply in that ego state than women. Okay, number three, the mainline media provides accurate and truthful information. Well, the public is going to all kinds of alternative news. Right now, GCN Network has 52 talk show hosts. And Alex Jones leads the charge, and there's one after another with very, very good content and programming. My answer to that about mainline media is that the public is increasingly aware of the use of the mainline media to manipulate the public. This is becoming commonplace in talks now, in circles of friends and small groups of people. Okay, number four, governments create jobs and wealth. Are you kidding me? This is where Obama fails miserably. The truth about that is businesses create jobs, government does not. Governments create taxes and expenses, and they confiscate wealth. They do not create wealth. Number five, the ultimate wealthy fund only capitalism. Now, this is where they've got us tricked into thinking that the big, big money, they're all capitalists, and they hate these left-leaning socialists and communists and Marxists and so forth. Actually, they've been funding most of these, the wealthy, the ultimate wealthy had been funding. They set up the Fabian Society in the 1880s in the United Kingdom. And also go to, and read Anthony Sutton. And I have a click off in there, and he's written some very marvelous books about the financing of the Bolsheviki Revolution, 1917, by the wealthy in this country, in England and Europe. And also, he has a lot to say about the secret societies, the Skull and Bones. He has a book on that. So Anthony, A-N-T-O-N-Y. Many people say Anthony, but that's not correct. That's not his correct first name. It's Anthony Sutton, S-U-T-T-O-N. Okay, number six, the Federal Reserve System is owned by the federal government. Well, it's becoming very, very prevalent now and very common to hear that the Federal Reserve is privately owned. Who wrote the definitive book on that is G. Edward Griffin, The Creature from Jekyll Island. And that was just a marvelous book. Now, you can get that book and a silver dollar from Midas Resources. This company that we broadcast on also has Midas Resources, and they trade in silver and gold. You can call 1-800-686-2237, 1-800-686-2237, and ask about the G. Edward Griffin book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, and they'll also send you one silver dollar. So that's a heck of a deal, I would say. Anyway, we're going to get back to our list of seven ideas of slavery. And we just about out of time here, so we'll have to take this up later. Thank you for listening. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got our next guest coming up. Is really a fantastic reporter and journalist. His name is Tony Gosling. He's done so much with BBC. He has his own drive time program now out of Bristol, England. It's called Friday Drive Time. If you go to thesecrettruth.com, you'll be able to find those click-offs there. And Tony recently, he broke a story about the Olympics that really, really caused an uproar. Welcome to our program, Tony Gosling.
Hi, George. Thank you very much. Yes, I'm a journalist. I'm not a celebrity announcer. So that's what we actually need, I think, in broadcasting these days, is people who are actually prepared to go out and dig out new stuff rather than just sort of churn out press releases or, sort of put their makeup on, clean their teeth and smile sweetly on the TV. But this story, I mean, to be fair, I have to give the credit for the Olympic story, partly anyway, to the censorship of the mainstream media, because the undercover reporter, a guy who's a filmmaker who's worked with Stanley Kubrick in the past, I mean, he decided that when he saw the Olympics looming that he was going to get a job as a security guard just to see really, what kind of training they were being given and just to get a bit of an inside insight. He's worked for, BBC and various other documentary type programs here in Britain doing investigative proper journalism. And what he discovered when he was going undercover, his name's Ben Fellows, was that the entire Olympic event, which has been run by a privatized security company, the security side of things, called G4S, that was a very small, 20 years ago, it was a tiny company here in Britain. Now it's an absolute one of the biggest companies in the world, doing security all over the world, including Palestinian checkpoints, helping them, that kind of thing. He discovered that there was a totally inadequate training going on. His first instinct was to go to some of the mainstream broadcasters and newspapers. And this, for me, has been one of the lessons of this, is that basically our mainstream media, and this is a really almost a sort of technical forensic bit of evidence, that it is simply not fit for purpose. He had all this evidence that things weren't going as they should be, which any kind of self-respecting press would pick up on. Of course they want to do feel-good stories for the Olympics, but there was an absolute brick wall he hit. So he came to me, and we ran a 40-minute interview with him explaining all the ins and outs of what was wrong, including things like drug deals going down in the training classes, the fact that the equipment simply wasn't able to do the work, the x-ray machines. He was smuggling machetes through the x-ray machines, guns through, this kind of thing. And we found eventually that interview we did 3 weeks ago went viral online in various forms, mostly the YouTube films, and there were several that went up and then went down again. Anyway, subsequent to that, various of us circulated that interview around really going through, doing our civic duty, I suppose, sending it through to the various authorities, including LOCOG, the people who are supposed to be organising the Olympics. And these are the big Olympic organisers, chaired by Sebastian Coe, who's a former British Olympic champion sprinter. And lo and behold, a couple of weeks later, boom, this massive story, which is, it broke Wednesday afternoon here in Britain, and it actually is still leading the bulletins today. So that's Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 4 days of news coverage on this particular story. I mean, we're all a little bit gobsmacked, but very pleased that now we're in a situation where it does look like we're going to have less chance of terror or fake terror or false flag style shenanigans going on at the Olympics this year.
Right. Is it going to come off okay, I guess? So they had to pull a bunch of soldiers in? Is that what happened, Tony?
Well, essentially what's happened is proper investigations have been done into whether G4S are actually able to deliver what they're contracted to deliver as regards security, and they've been found wanting in many, many respects. And what's happened is essentially that the teams that G4S for us had been organising to do things like pedestrian screening coming into the Olympics are now being scrapped and replaced with teams led by trained professional soldiers and similar, you know. So basically that's what's happened, is that there's been a I suppose a replacement of the managerial command structure on the immediate approaches to the games, just to make sure that somebody responsible is in charge in all the pedestrian screening areas, rather than untrained, unvetted security guards just taken straight off of the unemployment queues, who some of whom can't even speak the language.
Right. Is this going to cost like something like 50 million pounds more? Is that what this mistake will basically manifest in?
Well, that's what we're hearing. And also G4S are complaining that they're going to actually lose money on this Olympic contract, which I think is the least of their worries, really. I mean, I think what it's done is it's smashed their reputation as an organisation. I think it may be very difficult for them to get security contracts in the future. Now, I mean, one of the reasons I think that this has been so difficult for the mainstream press to deal with is that this is an up-and-coming business with a very good, strong reputation, and taking literally billions in public money in different parts of the world every year. And so nobody wants to really stomach the idea that, well, maybe that they've got it completely wrong on one of the most important contracts they've ever taken on. And so there is a sort of inertia, really, to big businesses like this that people don't like to think that this. And also, of course, with the Olympics, it's not the story that people want to tell. But it's very important, quite clearly, to make sure that people like G4S do not get away with this kind of thing, that they can't just simply take public money and provide a shoddy service, you know, for all that hard-earned taxpayers' money.
Right. You seem to, in some of your videos in Russia Today and so forth, you seem to put forward the idea that the G4S is a method to privatize much of the public police force and so forth. What's happening in that area? Is that public-private partnership type of mechanisms or what?
Well, it's not really, no. I mean, we actually here in Bristol, we've got in Avon and Somerset Constabulary. That's one of the, you know, we've got something like 40 different constabularies in Britain, all independent of each other, but, you know, working together. Was one of the first to actually start privatisation of the backroom office, as things like the payroll, you know, civilian support staff for the police have been privatised here for something like 7 or 8 years. Now, as a sideline to that, the contract with IBM has been what many of the ordinary police you speak to around here, off the record, will tell you has been a total disaster. Things like they've been spending half their day trying to get their expenses into the system, this kind of thing. You know, basically, it's a very, very clunky system that just simply hasn't been delivering. Even though, of course, as often with these IT projects, you know, all these amazing things are promised. But, I mean, the amazing thing about the timing of all this, George, is that literally under a month ago, one of the headlines on The Guardian was the boss of G4S actually saying that within 5 years, all of Britain's police will be privatised, and that G4S hopes to be running most of those private policing contracts.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Welcome back, Tony Gosling.
Hi, George.
Yeah, you know, the G4S, they only were awarded this contract a little over a year ago. Is that correct?
Well, the contract was expanded a little over a year ago. But, of course, what is actually going on in the House of Commons last week on Thursday, there was a discussion about all this. And what the parliamentarians have been saying is, look, guys, you know, you knew you were the main business in the running for this, and you've had 5-6 years to prepare. So we're not talking about some little thing that's just popped up overnight. You know, quite honestly, the whole country is kind of incredulous. I mean, this is where our country's on show. You know, once every 20, 30 years or so, we do this. I mean, I think there are all sorts of other problems with the games, but I mean, this particularly, I mean, one of the pieces I did on the Russia Today, I was talking about the prostitution of the games, about it all being economic determinism. And I mean, that is, it seems what it's like. The last time we did the games was in 1948, and it was very, you know, Britain would just, you know, come out of the Second World War. We were really in a bit of a state. You know, it wasn't very easy to do it, but we did it. And we didn't have loads and loads of sponsorship. It wasn't seen as some kind of sticky bun affair where everyone's trying to make money and, you know, get money out of the people who are coming to do the food. The idea, the focus was on the athletics. And my feeling is that the games now has become this kind of super hyped event, which is all about the usual suspects, mates of the people, you know, sort of cronies of the people in the central government, the Cameronites and the elite, the rich elite, using it to make money. But not only that, they're using a tremendous number of horrendous sponsors. I mean, we've got, they've treated also the local people in the area where the games are taking place appallingly. I mean, really, no proper compensation for them not being able to get backwards and forwards to their workplaces, this kind of thing. This is the sort of thing we're now hearing. And it seems like this kind of nightmare has descended on that part of London for 2-3 weeks. And the locals are just up in arms about it, with loads of people moved. So it seems that the people organising it are kind of nasty types. You know, all they want is the money, organise their games. They're very, very self-centred and self-absorbed. And, so this is nothing like those lovely 1948 games. A company that used to be called Union Carbide, now bought by Dow Chemicals, they're one of the major sponsors. And just to top it all, there's local car dealerships, the people that can't actually get into their firms, the taxis aren't allowed to go near the games, but BMW are, because they've paid a massive amount of money for sponsorship of the games. Now, BMW, just to remind you, is actually a company. I mean, you could even call it a Nazi company, because it made its money, the family, the Quant family, Günter Quant particularly, during the Second World War on slave labour in concentration camps, manufacturing batteries for their company at the time, which was called ABB, for the Nazi submarines and tanks and the war effort. Now, that money at the end of the war was then taken out because obviously they wanted to sort of wash their hands of all that slave labour, dirty Nazi money, and they put it into this little company called BMWs. Bought it up as a private concern, and it's still a private concern. You can't buy shares in BMW. And this company actually, whereas many of the other companies such as Porsche, Volkswagen, Mercedes, all put money into funds after the war, more recently, to basically compensate families of victims of the Holocaust and the concentration camps, BMW refused to do so. They wouldn't even reply to the letters from the spares funds. And then in 2008, there was an amazing documentary went out in Germany called The Silence of the Quants, obviously a play on the Silence of the Lambs film. And this was really to do with where they got their money from, and also the seeming denial of the Quant family to actually admit the fact that their wealth was based on slave labour. And this is the firm that Sebastian Coe and his low-cog mates, in their wisdom, have chosen as an appropriate firm to be sponsoring this year's Olympics, basically, just because they've got the money, you know. And I think that basically Londoners are not impressed, really, with this kind of attitude, and I don't think that they're doing the country proud by allowing such companies to sponsor, especially when the ordinary London cabbies are not allowed to get very near the games. The only people that can do that are these BMW cars. It's a damn insult, if you ask me.
My gosh, I mean, they won't even let cabs close by. I mean, that is outrageous, isn't it?
Well, what it means is that people are going to have to walk around about half an hour from where the taxis drop them to actually get to the venues, whereas especially for elderly people, it may be longer than that. But these sponsored BMW BMW cars will be able to go right up to the entrances. Now, this is just simply, you know, elitism, isn't it? This is a, it's a kind of, in a microcosm, it's showing you the kind of mentality that is behind the games. It's all about favouritism, favours for friends, and basically BMW have bribed their way right into the gate. And ordinary London cab drivers, who, by the way, are really struggling to make a living in these times, with all the regulations that are being put on them, etc., are being left out in the cold, George.
Oh, man, this is just outrageously unfair. These cabbies are trying to make a living every day, and London is a big place, and it needs every cabbie that they can get their hands on, don't you think, Tony?
Yeah, I do. And also the bus drivers in London, I'm not quite sure whether the strike's going to go ahead, but they've certainly had a ballot, and successful ballot amongst the bus drivers to go on strike during the Olympics, because they, in past times when we've had big events on in the city, there's been compensation payments made to the bus drivers because, you know, because the traffic is so appalling, they're getting home every day late, they're having loads of extra stress during the day, so the Transport for London, that runs London Transport, has been, you know, quite rightly, has made extra payments, not massive extra payments, but a small bit every week in the pay packet of the bus drivers to compensate them for all the extra stress and getting home late. Now, they've refused to do that this year, and that's under the auspices of the Conservative Mayor, Boris Johnson, who's, you know, really, if he was to weigh in on the bus driver's side, they would get the payment, but he won't do that. And so, you know, everyone in London is feeling that maybe this Games is coming along with a rather nasty taste in the mouth. Even though all the glitz is there and the marketing and the glamour, you know, actually it's something which people would rather is over with rather quickly. And I don't think we're in England, we're particularly in Britain generally, into these kind of massive hyped events with this sort of multinational, multi-million pound, multi-million dollar sponsorship. We'd rather just be there for the athletics and enjoy it for its own sake rather than have to look at all these logos all the time.
Well, I tell you, this thing is just blowing up into just a menagerie. They said on TVC that this is scandalous. I mean, this is just totally unacceptable. Is that? It's incredulous. Is that what's happening? Oh, just one thing after another on this Olympic game.
That's right. Well, I think in a way, George, there's a British sort of stiff upper lip kind of attitude been going on here, and complete denial of the facts. And what's happened actually is just the army have stepped in to deal with it. And there's something quite nice about that, in that at the end of the day, there are, you know, we do have the resources to deal with these things, and also it's done without too much grumbling by the forces. They'll move in, they will do the job, and this private upstart business G4S will be left with egg all over their face.
Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Welcome back to our program, Tony Gosling.
Thanks very much for having me, George.
Boy, I tell you what, now, this needs Nazi connections. Boy, you've been publicizing that quite vigorously, have you not?
I certainly have. I mean, you know, I was brought up in the 1960s, 1970s, you know, really on a diet of anti-Nazi programs. I mean, we had a program over here, I'm not sure if you had it in the US, called The Pathfinders, for example, which was all about the battles of the RAF against the Nazis. This was a stock in trade of everything we were watching as kids on the TV, the stuff we would see in the Saturday morning pictures down the local town. As our parents were off shopping, you know, the kids would be stuck into the cinema and we would be sitting watching this stuff. And then, you know, but I was left with the impression that, oh, well, it was all over with. Now, when I first came across the Bilderbergers as a professional journalist, you know, I started looking into this, and to see that this organisation that no journalists either seemed to want to talk about or knew about, on the national scene anyway, that I'd spoken to, that, you know, it was either something they didn't want to talk about at all, or they just didn't have a clue what it was about, to see that this organisation was actually founded by a Nazi, that it included, you know, some of the key players in the British political and economic and energy company scenes, and the media, and the same with the United States and many other countries in Europe, basically being a kind of shadow political conference for NATO, it just set, it really, really sent shivers down my spine to see something which was really quite so secretive and powerful, and yet founded by a Nazi. That is Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. Now, Bernhard is an interesting figure. I mean, he managed to convince our king, George VI, during the Second World War, that he'd completely changed his ways. He was now a very enthusiastic Dutch person fighting for the Dutch people, but there were other people that he didn't convince of that. Now, one of those was the US military during the Second World War. Didn't trust him as far as they could throw a stone, George, and they wouldn't have him anywhere near any of their operations, their secret stuff. The same with the Royal Navy. They would have nothing to do with Bernhard. The Royal Air Force gave him his own plane, hopefully, I mentioned, so he could just sort of go away somewhere in it, maybe, but the real problem was, because he had been positively vetted by George VI himself, and let's not forget that Edward VIII was himself a Nazi. He absconded, when he abdicated, he absconded off with this Nazi agent, Mrs. Simpson. And John Loftus told us, I mean, I think I mentioned this last time, that he actually tried to get into Nazi Germany in 1939 through France, and he was arrested by MI6, and so they said, no, we're not having the abdicated King of England broadcasting right across Europe on the airwaves in favour of Hitler, thank you very much. And so he was then carted off to the Bahamas and left there to be governor of the Bahamas for the war, where they could keep a close eye on him. But as you can see, you know, you've got a Nazi connection in the royal family with that. You've also got this rather worrying concept of George VI ordering or requesting politely Ian Fleming, you know, the James Bond guy who was in MI6 at the time, to positively vet Bernhard so that he could be involved with Monty and other, I mean, this is Brian Horrocks as well, Eisenhower was involved in planning this Operation Market Garden. So, you know, what we've got here, which was a total disaster, by the way, and allowed the Nazis to have their extra 6 months they needed to get their loot out of Berlin and secrete it around different parts of the world, some in Scandinavia, a lot of it in South America, as we now know. And so this is really quite a worrying thing for me, to come across this character, Prince Bernhard, who certainly looked had been, certainly had been in the Nazi Party, had been in the SS, and it looked like had been a Nazi spy in World War II, fronting this organisation right from the mid-1950s up until 1975, when he'd been caught red-handed by a very resourceful chambermaid in a Dutch hotel who found a piece of paper which proved that Bernhard had been paid $1 million by Lockheed as a bribe to get the Dutch government to buy the Lockheed Starfighter. So any of your military people who knew this aircraft will know it was a bit of a dog's breakfast of an aircraft. It kept falling out of the sky. But Bernhard had taken the money from Lockheed, and sure enough, the Dutch Air Force had bought these starfighters, which maybe they kept for a couple of years and then scrapped them. But anyway, you know, so he was totally discredited from start to finish. And coming across him as the lead man in this organisation really did send shivers down my spine. So that's when I suppose I got onto the trail of the resurgent Bormann network, the Nazi network, which carried on after the Second World War quietly, based in Paraguay, Argentina, Brazil, and quite deliberately on these border countries, so that if one country turned against this Nazi network, they could just quickly slip across the border into another country. And it was an economic empire. And I think that's one of the things that we're certainly facing today, is an economic, fascist-oriented, cultic empire, which is now, you know, basically got its roots into all of our major, particularly things like food and energy corporations, media corporations, and behind the scenes, these are the guys who are behind this kind of mess. particularly, and on the radio, where you've got, rather than journalists doing the work, you've got these celebrity people now, and you've got the dumbing down of the media. Now, I mean, that is something which is being done by the owners. It's not being done by the journalists at the coalface or the programme producers necessarily. It's being done by the owners. They're putting the people in place that they think will be most effective in basically giving us kind of dumbed-down media. So I think it's, you know, that's what's going on, as I see it today, George, this Bormann network. And Bormann, of course, was someone who Bernhard probably almost, well, he would have known because he was there as well at the beginning of the early days of the Nazi Party. And, of course, Bernhard actually denied that he was ever a Nazi, but the documents have come out recently that, of course, he was a Nazi in the Nazi Party just after it had first formed, when he was at college, at university. So Bormann was Hitler's number two, basically, and after the Second World War, he got across to South America and he set up these 750 businesses, corporations in different parts of the world. He was basically a little bureaucrat beavering away there, and these corporations were then given laundered Nazi money to get them going, and also former SS people to take off their Thunder Flash SS uniform badges and their skulls, the skulls on their caps, and just saunter into various boardrooms around the world and start doing business.
Many of those 750 corporations, has anyone done any tracking about what existing corporations today that Bormann had funded back from out of Argentina and so forth? Has anyone done any research?
Well, that's great. That's the question, isn't it, in a way? And Paul Manning, who wrote this book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, he put 2 years of his life. Manning was working as a CBS news correspondent, a real journalist in the Second World War, bringing the news of what was going on in Europe to you in the US.
Oh, by the way,
after the war, I think it was around about the 1960s and 70s, he decided on his own, just as one guy, without any financial backing at all, to put that 20 years into digging out everything he could about this Bormann network, the Nazi network going on in South America. And that's what he did, and he put it all together in this book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, which
I have as a download on the site, and also I have Harry Eckhouse's book as a download also.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I'm glad you got that. But you see, this is where...
And then below that, I have that article out of the, I want to say, the end of Daily Mail about the Nazis planned the Fourth Reich. You remember the meeting that they had?
Yeah, that's right. This is the Red House meeting, and that goes back, you know, deep into the middle of, toward the end of the Second World War, after B-Day. I mean, this is the way it worked, basically, is that the Nazis realized, Hitler included, that it looked like they were going to lose the war.
For this end of this first hour, but we'll welcome you back 6 minutes after the top of the hour. And boy, I really appreciate all the hard work you're doing on this, Tony.
It's not your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Our chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out grace with me. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Right smack dab in the middle of it. Right smack dab in the middle. We are right smack dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Welcome back, Tony Gosling. Hey, let me ask you a question about Nazi hunting post-World War II. What happened why were they not able to find more of these Nazis, in your opinion?
Well, first of all, I think it took a few years for people to realize. I mean, I think but the intelligence services certainly had been very much aware of this whole Operation Safe Haven, which was the Nazis' name for their flight capital operation, you know, to get all these securities, the gold, other valuables, cash, paintings, this kind of thing, out of Berlin. And to make sure that when the Allies arrived, there was nothing there. So, you know, that process had been followed to a certain extent by the intelligence services. But I think, you know, there was a conscious effort from on high to sort of slowly roll back those investigations to try and track down those war criminals, largely because the word was out that the big new enemies were the Russians, and that, you know, maybe some of these Nazis might come in handy in fighting with the Cold War. So that was the main, I think, reason why the brakes were put onto those investigations. Now, it certainly carried on for a few years after, immediately after the war, but then stopped. The only country that was then really pursuing these Nazi war criminals was Israel, for obvious reasons. And the Israeli Mossad, who had just been formed, one of their first tasks was gathering intelligence on where some of these particularly worst of the war criminals, people like Klaus Barbie and Martin Bormann, people who'd been instrumental in the whole sort of exercise, but also talking about Adolf Eichmann. They were keeping tabs on these people, even though they hadn't necessarily been acting against them. So, you know, really, the Israeli Mossad filled a vacuum there when the Brits and the Americans backed off from pursuing these Nazi war criminals.
Did they have all that money, too, to bargain with, did they not?
Well, certainly, that certainly played a part in it. But that really kicked in after the arrest of Adolf Eichmann in the early 60s. I mean, what happened, basically, he was kidnapped by Issa Harel, who was the Mossad guy in charge of the operation to look after, you know, to actually go and get these guys. I mean, they've been gathering intelligence for a long time and took the actual operational side of it to you know, put these Nazi war criminals on trial. He was charged with kidnapping them. And there was a really good documentary went out in Britain about all this, which is available online, as part of an old documentary series, which is kind of, you know, it's disappeared really off the face of the earth now, but there are still these old recordings. They're not making programs anymore. It's called World in Action. It was an old Granada TV based in Manchester production by John Ware, who's now actually the head of Panorama, which is the BBC's investigative series, but he's now a kind of gatekeeper, or he's gatekept by somebody else. They're not doing anything really. Anything like this kind of level of investigative journalism. And the program went out in the 70s and interviewed Issa Harel, who'd been doing this hunt, and it's called The Hunt for Dr. Mengele, a World in Action investigation into claims that Paraguay is a refuge for Nazi criminals, including Mengele. And that's an hour-long investigative documentary, which is pretty eye-popping stuff. And they are actually talking to the people who were involved in the kidnap of Adolf Eichmann. And he was what Harel was doing is he was trying. He'd managed to kidnap Eichmann, and he was sitting on the runway in Paraguay, waiting to be flown back to Israel to be put on trial. And Harel was given a couple of days while this plane was sitting there, maybe even less than that, to actually get any other Nazi war criminals that he could to get them on this plane. He was very close to getting Martin Bormann, but Martin Bormann had just moved out of the boarding house, and so he managed to miss him. So the plane went back with Adolf Eichmann to Jerusalem. Eichmann was put on trial and then executed. and Harold was a bit disappointed that he didn't manage to get any more of these Nazis. I mean, he had some very, very good information on where they were as well, and he had other agents that were following them around near the Brazilian border. And he even, in this documentary, they tracked down, this is John Ware and his team, they had a German woman who you never actually see on camera, but you hear her speaking in German to these people, and she's working with another woman who's running a hidden camera. And what they do is they talk to a lot of these key Nazis. There's one guy who was hiding many of them, and they're in some ways quite open about the fact that they are running some sort of Nazi network there. And she's very clever. What she does is she says, oh, well, you know, I'm a supporter of the SS and people are after me and I need help. And of course she was, you know, then they sort of open up to her and speak to her, and that's why I think here in Britain, we, you know, we were very lucky to have that insight into what was going on. Even though the reason that that nobody else of these war criminals was got, first of all, they had the president of Paraguay on their side. He was doing everything he could to thwart anyone who was after this lot. He was a fascist himself, of course. He was having to cope, and in Uruguay there was the Tupamaros, but they were having to cope with basically a US-backed Nazi-style operation against, you know, sort of independence movements in South America. So, Issa Harrell was tapped on the shoulder by his higher-ups in Israel, and they were saying, look, you know, these Nazi network, we know that they're naughty people, but they're actually helping to fund us here in Israel, and you're going to have to back off from this hunt. And he was actually sacked, Harold, who'd managed to arrest Eichmann and get him back and put on trial and executed, was sacked from his job. And I think, you know, in many ways you can track that year, 1963, I think it was, when he was sacked, as the year that Israel kind of lost its soul, because, you know, it plays very much on this whole thing of getting the Nazis, as we do, you know. And yet that was the point at which really Mossad gave up its pursuit of Nazi war criminals. And you know, Nazi money talks, just like other money talks, and I'm afraid it can even buy Jewish leaders and the leadership it bought at that time.
So you think by about 1963, the real hunting of Nazi criminals was subdued somewhat, and not came to a screeching halt, but it became less of a major goal. What do you think?
Well, I mean, there was a lot of the intelligence gathering going on and some journalism going on, but the actual operational stuff to do with kidnapping people, putting them on trial, and giving them a fair trial, and then, you know, if necessary, then going to the gallows or else life imprisonment, as happened to Rudolf Hess, that had really come to a halt at that point. And you know, to pick up on another point you made about Paul Manning's book, how do we know? I mean, he's the one who's done all of this primary research. So, I mean, if any of your listeners would like to, you can get hold of a PDF copy of that book. And there's a tremendous amount of work still to be done to dig out the connections between
murdered up in New York, yeah.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN. Great talk radio starts here.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. Welcome back, Tony.
Yeah,
Tony Austin, welcome back. How are you, man?
Yes, I'm fine, George.
Hey. You know, there was a dispute between about Adolf Eichmann's capture between Simon Wiesenthal and Harrell. Is that right?
Well, that's right. You see, afterwards, Wiesenthal tried to claim that he'd been instrumental in this capture, this kidnap, whereas actually Harrell said that he was trying to throw him off the scent, that he was saying he was that Bormann was actually, yes, he was alive, but he was in other parts of the world. And there was a kind of stony silence from Harrell for a while, but then he decided he was going to actually speak out about Wiesenthal and the way that Simon Wiesenthal had tried to sort of hijack and piggyback on his hard work. And you know, in a way, I think many people will look at Wiesenthal as someone who was, he decided that he was going to sort of be the big guy who was the big Nazi hunter. And you know, the you know, of course, this is all top secret work at the time, and it's very difficult for someone to actually come out from undercover and say, well, actually, what this guy's saying is nonsense. So it was quite, in a way, quite, you know, extraordinary that Harold did actually come out and say, well, what we've been told saying is simply not true. You know, there is that whole aspect to it that many people now are looking at Simon Wiesenthal, and of course you've got in the US there the Simon Wiesenthal Center, as someone that wasn't playing an entirely straight bat over this, and he also was refusing to give credit where it was due to the people who were really doing the job.
Yeah, you know, that big money, what was it, reported to be $183 billion that Bormann brought out of Germany between 1943 and 45, is that right?
Well, that's right. That would be quite a big sum today, George, wouldn't it?
Well, what would the equivalent of $183 billion be today? Do you know?
Well, I think you can add at least a zero to the end of it. You know, so we're talking about, coming on for a trillion, aren't we?
$1 trillion, you think? Something like that?
But anyway, certainly a fantastic amount of money.
It looked like the Americans, of course, through Paperclip, Operation Paperclip, brought a bunch of German scientists, well, that's proven fact, into this country, the United States. And then they used them, you know, there were psychological testing and you know what I mean, mind-washing programs in these universities and so forth. And that's what happened. They just used all the top scientists that they could.
Yeah, I think at this point it might be nice to plug Peter Lavender's book on all this, the Sinister Forces series, because he has done, whatever it was, 3 or 4 years ago, a fantastic job in pulling together a lot of threads from that whole kind of MKUltra mind control, Ewan Cameron kind of aspect, the Jim Jones, the way it was kind of linked in with the whole horrendous with the People's Temple.
Yeah, you know Jolly West out of Stanford area there?
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway, he shows up with McVeigh, counseling with McVeigh when he was in prison, being held before he was tried and executed. See what I mean?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if we had any really decent TV documentary makers today making stuff for mainstream television, is they would be picking up on a lot of the threads that people like Peter Lavender have pulled together. Because, of course, he wrote that book years ago, which I read not long after it first came out, called Unholy Alliance, where he actually took a trip down to South America to Colonia Dignidad, which was on the Chilean Argentinian border, famously, basically a Nazi torture camp, which was being used as part of the Pinochet regime to torture people, where they had torture chambers, where people were being tortured electrically by remote control from another control room. The idea being that the people who were actually being tortured would never actually see the people doing the torturing. So if they got away, they would never actually be able to go to court and say, well, this is the guy that did it. You know, this is a horrendous kind of episode. But Peter Lavender amazingly just sort of went down there with his car and he hired a car because no taxis were taken there, and his camera, and then wrote a book about it. And then he's gone on now to write this book, this series, Sinister Forces, a grimoire of American political witchcraft, where he brings together some amazing threads throughout, you know, sort of post-war world with JFK, and everything is in there pretty much. And I'd just like to recommend that as a really good source for pulling some of these threads together. And, you know, maybe someone will make a documentary about this stuff at some point. You know, I think that's really where the cutting edge is in the primary research today.
Right. You know, at the top of this big power system, the word fascism is a mentality, is it not, Tony? That when we say fascism, we're not necessarily talking about the German fascists or the Italians. It's a mindset, is it not, of authoritarianism, totalitarianism? How would you explain fascism, Tony?
Yeah, it's this whole concept which Gordon Duff talks about, which is economic determinism, and a lot of people talk about it. Gordon's just one that uses the expression quite a bit, which means that basically he who has the money decides everything, and there is no law outside that. I mean, we've got that situation in the City of London. We have had since the Blue Arrow trial back in 1992, where the powers that be in London, that is to say the cults, I'm talking about the people that are in the judiciary, the sort of Freemasonic, this kind of thing, the Knights Templar style, high-level Freemasonic cults, who said, okay, we'll make sure that there are no more prosecutions of bankers in the city. And that opened the door to... Literally, it was a green light to money laundering, to defrauding clients, to accounting fraud, all that kind of, you know, cooking the books. And that's why we're in the situation we are now, is because we've got that culture of impunity. And I go back to this whole thing of the cults. I mean, you know, DSS was a cult. It was a Hitler worship cult. It was a death cult. And we've had these things throughout history. And I think ultimately, George, I think you probably agree with me, that the struggle we're in now will be ultimately a struggle to rid humanity of this menace. You know, we've gone back to, you go back to medieval times, it was the Knights Templar, it was the cult of the assassins. You know, even in the Middle East, the assassins cult was secretly in touch with the Templar cults. You know, so even though one was supposed to be a Muslim organization and the other a Christian, they were secretly working behind the scenes. I mean, we had then in medieval times also the Order of the Garter. Today, we've got something in Britain here called the Blinden Club on the Daily, in the Daily Mail, Mail on Sunday tomorrow. There's another expose of George Osborne, our Chancellor of the Exchequer, getting involved in locking somebody into a portable toilet and rolling it down a hill. And these kind of japes had a rather nasty side to them, which involved things like drugs and, you know, blooding people, that is to say, cutting them physically, one person cutting another person, and goodness knows what else they get up to. But I think, you know, we do need a full exposure of, I mean, Cameron's in the Bullingdon Club, several other key people, even David Dimbleby, who chairs our BBC Question Time every week on the TV, where we have an hour-long political discussion. He is a Bullingdon Club boy. And so, yeah, Boris Johnson, the Mayor of London, was the Bullingdon Club boy. So, I mean, that's what I would point to, is this really identification of the cults.
Welcome back to the Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Welcome back, Tony Gosling.
Thanks for having me again, George.
Yeah, you know, you're talking about cults, aren't you? And the word synergism seems to come up in my mind, where you've got the idea of secret societies controlling a government from behind the scenes. And what they've done is create these intelligence agencies, and they're hiding their actions under the cloak or behind the veil of national security. Well, what would be your comments?
Yeah, I think, I mean, this is one of the things that Paul Manning's son says, and he's interviewed, an interview I was circulating around a couple of days ago, is that there was a kind of core in the CIA, and there's now a core in many of the intelligence agencies around the Western world, which is actually, you know, for want of a better word, a Nazi group, you know, a part of this cult. And that these people, I mean, although there are many, you know, honourable, decent people working in these organisations, I mean, in a way, it's kind of signified in that famous film, The Ipcress File. I think it was Len Dayton that wrote the original book, where you've got a sort of factions within the intelligence services, some of whom are upholding the rule of law, and others of whom are working to a totally another agenda. In other words, they're trying to get wars started, an Orwellian-style agenda, really, in order to justify their own existence and also to increase their own power base. Now, one of the big spin-offs from all this, of course, is the draconian laws and the destruction of civil liberties. We've got this thing now going in the UK with Kenneth Clark, the Bilderberg guy, the main Bilderberg representative for Britain, who chooses other people who are going to come from Britain to the Bilderberg conferences, is instituting this whole process of secret courts, even secret inquests, which the British Legion, which is the you know, the Poppy Day thing we have from the First World War and the Second World War Remembrance Sunday, they organise ex-servicemen are called monstrous. And you know, this is the spin-off from it all, is that actually the people who are really destroying our civil liberties are not in caves in Afghanistan. They haven't got beards. They're not Muslims. They are actually traitors within our own ranks, within our own superstructure. there in the power structure. That's where these people are nowadays. And I must not forget, one other person from the Bullingdon Club, of course, is Nathaniel Rothschild. And key family, really, I think, if you're looking at the financing of a lot of the dodgy stuff that's going on in the world. And also, of course, one of the central private banking powers. I come back to this idea, really, which is now sort of gaining a bit more credence in Britain, which is that banking is a utility. It's there to serve the needs of the public. It is not something which lends itself well to the secrecy that goes with private enterprise, with all this kind of, commercial confidentiality. Actually, if banking is done openly, it will work a hell of a lot better than if it's, if it's done behind all these walls of secrecy, as it is at the moment, as we're finding what was going on in Barclays, where you've got traders making decisions about LIBOR rates, sitting next to other people who stand to gain from that same decision. And the idea that, one person in a company inside the same building is not going to talk to another is an absolute farce. So I think the only way to run banking is as some kind of a public service, and we've just got to get back to that. Simply think of it as something which is basically just like a basic function of society, like the water company or whatever, the water board, as we used to have after World War II here. And we've had a whole succession of privatisations here, which have led us in a really bad direction. Our railways now are basically, for many people, it's actually far too expensive to go anywhere by train. I mean, you've got the same thing in the US, where the motor industry has so controlled transport that, really to get around, you need to have a car and you need to be buying their fuel. Everybody's got to have their own engine. The public engines, that might take us around in public transport hardly exist anymore.
Right. This thing about this mentality, you know what I mean? I'm getting back to that a little bit. It has a very strong male characteristic, does it not? And this ego. These people that are at the top of this great pyramid of control and dominance and so forth, they have no feelings. It's psychopathic, seems like to me. What would your thoughts be?
Oh, yeah, certainly they're totally self-absorbed. That's the expression I would use. They're people who really only see things from their own perspective. I mean, in a way, you can see why the Bible talks about the enemy as the beast, because they do see themselves as sort of top dogs.
They are the beast, right? They're the beast.
Yeah, they see themselves as, basically they're stripped of their humanity. I mean, the thing is, George, and that might sound a bit crazy, but you have to have love for these people as well, because they have got into a mentality where they are actually, not thinking in any kind of sensible fashion. They believe that they have been totally alienated by their deeds from the rest of society, and they see it as some kind of massive competition. That the idea of sort of cooperating with the rest of humanity doesn't really enter their minds of people like Henry Kissinger. He sees the rest of society as the enemy, in a way, in a similar way to somebody like one of these Middle Eastern leaders would have during the Arab Spring. What they've done, for example, the Interior Minister in Egypt had actually sent some of his police down to bomb a Coptic Christian church. I think it was in Alexandria, just in the beginning of the uprising. And in order to try and get factional fighting going, as is happening now in Syria, obviously, as well, with NATO actually being one of the main instigators of the factional fighting and sectarianism. And so when you have that kind of, when you've done those sort of evil deeds, killing loads of innocent people in order to try and get infighting amongst the poorer people in society, you then have, by that deed, alienated yourself from the rest of humanity in your country, and you see them as the enemy. And that is the dangerous kind of mentality. And then these people will get together who have a similar kind of evil and have done similar bad deeds. And, of course, they are scared to death that when it's a bit like, for example, for the apartheid rulers in South Africa before black majority rule, they were scared to death that if the black majority rule was to happen, that these native Africans would do the same things to the white people, the Afrikaners, WB, the racists, as they had done to the native population. And so you get this hostility amongst people, which is just brought about by evil deeds. And, you know, that's the problem I think that we're in at the moment, is that bad things have been done, and the people that have done them are having to face up to the fact they've done these bad things, and are very, very nervous about not being in control. And that's what turns them into control freaks, as well as, you know, there are all sorts of sort of occultic rituals that many of the people involved in cults go through to bind them very, very closely to their personal friends and really alienate them from the rest of us.
Their madness or their psychopathic behavior has infected their followers and those that they dominate, and it's a pecking system of money dominance, money power, and these people are just outright mad, but they're at the top of the pyramid of power and banking and international finance. So they're building a house of madness and insanity. That's what they're doing.
No, I think you're right, yes. I mean, it'd be very, very simple for any kind of amateur psychiatrist to diagnose them as psychopaths. I mean, I noticed that Hillary Clinton this week was using the image of the hourglass, saying, well, the hourglass is running down for President Assad. Now, you know what this made me think of, George, is the Wicked Witch of the West in The Wizard of Oz. That was an image that was used in The Wizard of Oz, wasn't it? And, you know...
Hillary used that just recently in Syria.
Yes, exactly, yeah. So,
remember that?
I mean, it's almost as if Hillary has been watching The Wizard of Oz and then sort of identifying with the Wicked Witch of the West in the Wizard of Oz. And in fact, she, you know, in many ways, she is the Wicked Witch of the West.
And behind the tree curtain is a guy,
you know, in trying to mitigate this fighting armed revolution to bring about an internet regime.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio?
More important.
Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Welcome back to our program, Tony Gosling from Bristol, England.
Thanks, George.
what would you tell our audience about your site? And about your drive time, and then conclude anything that you feel that we left out.
There's always so much going on, but I found was a fantastic interview with a guy called Ronnie Casrils this week. He was one of the leaders of the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, and he was really talking about the various methods of media, really, as one of the key things in that struggle, where they actually managed to get the whole of humanity on their side, you know, through leafleting in South Africa and also through lobbying in capitals around the world. We also had a guy from the Tax Justice Network, which is based in London, which is doing what it can to expose the horrendous situation of offshoring tax havens and non-domicile people living in the United States who aren't actually U.S. citizens and therefore aren't paying any tax in America, and yet have vast amounts of wealth that isn't being taxed, and also people that put their money into the Cayman Islands. Now, you know, that's a British place, and even though we have our politicians constantly complaining about, oh, we must do something about this, of course they're never going to do anything about it because they've got their money in the Cayman Islands. And one of the things that John Christensen from the Tax Justice Network pointed out this week was that just here in Britain, I mean, I'll do it in dollars, but it's around about $150 billion extra a year the British taxpayer would get if they closed down some of these tax havens and stopped this tax avoidance, which is where people are making vast amounts of money, but paying that money into foreign companies which they control and own, and therefore they're not taxed at all on their income. In fact, even the BBC is doing this, as well as the government here, our civil service, are actually paying people, rather than taxing them as they're actually paid an income tax, they're paying them straight, and then they're leaving it for them to deal with the tax, whereas most people in Britain who are employed are getting their tax taken away at source. So this is if this money was collected, this tax was collected, there would be no financial crisis here in Britain, and we would actually be building houses, building schools, building hospitals, and society would be expanding. states in the U.S., but in Britain we have two big power bases. They're really the city financial power base and the feudal system, because we still really do have a feudal system, George. I don't know if you knew that, did you?
No, I didn't. I didn't know that.
Well, we've got the Queen, but, you know, we've got all of the barons and the dukes and the marquesses.
I understand that, because when you get back to the, aren't there three different, societies that take lawyers in on as membership before they can join the bar or something?
Well, that's the legal profession, but what I'm talking about is actually land ownership. And there's a guy, Kevin Carhill, who's a journalist who worked on the Sunday Times Rich List, you know, basically looking at who the richest people in Britain. And he has written a book called Who Owns Britain. Now, you'll be amazed to know, I mean, I was certainly amazed to know, that the families that own Britain are the same families that own the land. Have owned it, many of them, more or less since the Norman invasion, 1066. So, you know, we're talking about many hundreds and hundreds of years, the same families owning vast areas of different counties here in Britain. And that, of course, is a massive power base. But, I mean, I look at the feudal system as much more benign, because if you go to villages which are owned by these big feudal landlords, you find that actually people are fairly content. You know, they are paying not horrendous rents to these landlords. And also the services they get are often reasonably good. And there's a whole culture of landlordry that comes with those families, which we don't get in our cities. You know, it's very, very difficult to find decent landlords and decent rent in the city. So that's a big power base that people do consider. And they've been talking about reforming the Lords this last week, the House of Lords, which is many of whom are these big landowners. And I don't think there's a stomach for it here, really. But it does remind us that, you know, money is one thing, but land is actually one of the most important resources there is out there, and sources of wealth and sources of security. And I think until we in the West realise that we do have to actually sit down and make sure every single person in our countries has a stake in the country, a little bit like the old pioneering West, I suppose, where everybody has got their little stake in the ground, and there's nobody going to kick them off, nobody's going to evict them, there's going to be no foreclosures. If we can actually get our societies in the West to the state where we can assure everybody that you have this little patch of land, you can stay there, and no one is going to bring you off it, then I think we would have moved on a whole new level.
Yeah, we had the Homestead Act under Lincoln, I believe, and that gave a lot of people land ownership to a large number of people. And I think the United States, when we had the most people in the United States owning land underneath them for production, mostly farmers, that's when we probably reached the greatest freedom and democracy here. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do, and I think I agree with you. The thing is, if you've got a bit of land, you don't need to use it for farming, right? I mean, this is the thing a lot of people can't really get their heads around. If you don't need to use it for farming, you can just live there. As long as you've got somewhere to actually live, you can go and work anywhere you want to. You can go and drive into the city if you want, get a train into the city and work every day at a desk. But what you can do is no one is actually going to come along and take your land away from you. And this is one of the geniuses of the system, the crofting system that there is all over Scotland, in many of the Highlands particularly, is that because you actually don't physically own the actual land, you hold it from a big landowner from a peppercorn rent. And what it means is that you cannot use your house and your land as collateral against the loan, right? So, because only your immediate family or other people on the croft will be able to inherit that house and that home off of you. You can't be evicted, but when you die, if you don't have a son or daughter to take it off you, it just gets distributed amongst. So it's not actually valuable as collateral, so the banks can't get their hands on it. And this, I think, is a much, much better system. The idea that land, anyway, is something that you own, like, you know, say a book or a car or whatever. I mean, land is a common treasury for all. That's what the English Civil War did.
Well, you know, under the general lease system, you know how the land was returned to the original families, I believe, after the 50th year.
That's right. That's Jubilee. That's exactly
and the That's
a brilliant system, I think. And I think this
well,
is something
you know,
the
Occupy Movement. I was learning here in Bristol.
This is one of the things the Occupy Movement were talking about. Look, this is actually the time is coming where we really are going to have to start getting the basics right, you know, and start from scratch. And this is one of those things that's part of that because the Earth is a free gift to mankind. It's not one person's or a corporation, especially a Borman network corporation's private property to do with what they wish because everybody needs it and everybody needs somewhere secure to live. So, you know, I think we just got to think about that. I mean, I don't want to go too much into sort of the migration because, you know, people that kicked off land here in Britain, of course, they did over in the United States massively. You know,
well,
they did
what the greatest number of people owning the greatest amount of real estate that they could, you know. So we've, you know, a lot of people own their homes here in this country. And
well,
we do here as well.
I mean, probably not as many as in the U.S.
Well,
but what he's saying now
here,
is that he came up with my
government. So do we really own the land, or are we just leasing it from the tax collector?
Well, this is the problem. It's here in Britain, we are, even with freeholds, we hold those freeholds from the Queen. So the Queen, at any time she wants to, can come and take our freehold, which is rather annoying. That's in the Constitution here in Britain and in the whole
so, you know,
land holding system. And the
point
is that one of the
countries
in the world which actually gives the right to own land, but it can't then be taken off it by the state in Russia, funnily enough.
Yeah. Yeah, we're getting ready to sign off of here in just about less than a minute. Well, Tony, I appreciate your time and your getting up there at 1 o'clock in the morning, Sunday morning in Bristol. And you're always very, very insightful and very, very helpful to our listening audience here in the States.
Okay, George. Well, it's always lovely to hear from you. And, you know, I just think, you know, we've got to have some kind of a positive side to all this. And I think the Army moving on the Olympics is actually fantastic. It shows that we do take the threat of...
Well, let's hope and pray that we get through the Olympics without any major problems, okay?
Cheers, George. I'm sure it'll be okay.
Okay.
Cheers
to you. Thank you, Tony. I want to thank everybody for listening. The last thing is about delusion. We can easily become deluded. We need to come out by forgiving ourselves and others of the delusion. The delusion is real. We've got to stop being deluded. Thank you for listening.